Okay, this is session number 42, recorded on June 4th, 2007. This is side one. And we ended session 41. I was rereading a LaRouche quote. We're doing the LaRouche section of my book, and it got cut off. So I think I'll just reread it to put us back into the LaRouche mindset. And this is from 1984, LaRouche's essay, The Science of the Human Mind, A Treatise on Fundamentals, page 41 of that publication. It's The Campaigner, February 84. So the quote goes, I'll start at the beginning again. The key is the measurement of usable energy available per square kilometer. The level of biological reproduction potential is determined by the minimum value reached by a continuous supply of usable energy per capita. In what aspect of food gathering culture at the most primitive level is the supply of usable energy for human existence sufficiently concentrated to permit qualitative increase in population density? The answer is fishing. Fishing in italics, especially fishing near the mouths of important river systems. Then LaRouche gives his sequence, historical sequence of human development. The sequence of human development commonly given by anthropologists is 1, hunting and gathering society, in brackets, primitive society. 2, animal husbandry. 3, small garden patches supplementing animal husbandry. 4, agricultural revolution. 5, hydraulic society, hydraulic in quotes. Urban culture based on water management near the mouths of large river systems. So that's the normal anthropologist style for inventory. Now he says the Diodorus account and other evidence already cited give a different sequence. 1, fishing. 2, maritime culture leading into fixed urban settlements based on development of navigation through aid of astronomy. 3, development of the agricultural revolution by urbanized maritime society. 4, collapse of wide-ranging maritime culture, shifting the center of culture to a culturally lower level based on development of, quote, hydraulic societies around colonies of the collapsed maritime culture. So we discussed that in the previous session, and now we're going to go into the next LaRouche quote, which is about our time. And this is from, check it out here, this quote is from our FLL. It's an essay in November, December 1974, that particular issue of The Campaigner, and it's called Rockefeller's Fascism with a Democratic Face. Fascism with a Democratic Face is in quotations. So Rockefeller's Fascism with a Democratic Face, this is right around the time Nelson Rockefeller, governor of New York, is going to become vice president to replace Spiro Agnew. Nixon had resigned in August 74. Gerald Ford became president at that point, and Spiro Agnew had been knocked out earlier before Nixon resigned. So Gerald Ford has to appoint a new vice president, and right around November, December 74, Rockefeller, I think, is being questioned by Congress. And he passes that grilling, and then he's a vice president through 75 and 76, till Carter beats Ford in the fall of 76. McLuhan writes a section on how politicians will take over banking, or that banking would go into politics. Banking would take over politics. It was a essay McLuhan wrote around the same time, November, December 74. I don't know if I quote from it. But anyways, that's the timing of this. And Watergate has come out, has happened, so starting to talk about CIA and shadow government operations. So this is LaRouche's take, and it's pages 59 and 60 of that issue, November, December issue of Campaigner. So you want to read it, Scott?
Okay. The best qualified CIA...
No, the paragraph above it, the same sort.
Oh. The same sort of paranoid games apply to most forms of popular dramatic entertainments, novels, movies, plays, TV dramas, and, most emphatically, quote, soap operas. The ordinary, quote, formula, unquote, or plotto, that's, quote, plotto, that's capital P, sort of dramatic entertainment so popular on the TV is a halfway case between paranoid schizophrenia and the ordinary neurotic perception of events. Their value for both the neurotic is both catharsis and, equally important, suggesting new fantasy material to the observer. Literary drama and TV critics may be regarded as the Duncan Hines of the masturbation circuits. The best qualified CIA, quote, covert operations planning executives are to be found among hack paperback novelists and TV dramatists. The credulous neurotic projects reality onto the banal and TV screen, quote,
productions. Under the banal stage and TV.
Yeah, screen, quote, productions.
So that's the credulous neurotic projects reality onto the banal stage and TV screen productions in quotes.
Because of his strong desire to believe that the combination of painted backgrounds and papier-mâché costume and a montage has such reality. There is no way in which to conceal repeated, quote, covert operations, unless the public wishes to be credulous. Give that public a fantasy of the sort to which it is susceptible, and no amount of mere fact will easily dissuade the majority of such persons from believing in whatever illusion covert operation is designed to create. The application of calculated deception of the successful hack novelist and dramatist to the so-called, quote, documentary film, unquote, and, quote, nonfiction expose, unquote, is the connecting link between outright pornography writing and the techniques for designing a CIA-type, quote, covert operations, unquote, scenario. And in parentheses, if by chance a covert operation is, quote, blown, unquote, the CIA's obvious remedy is to prompt one of its subsidiaries or sister agencies to whip up a fresh expose of the CIA. Give the credulous public a, quote, believable, unquote, expose scenario, and the expose provides a deeper cover than the original plot itself. End of the parenthesis. It is not accidental, therefore, that the leaders in all branches of psychological warfare have included leading dramatists, novelists, and newspapermen. The accumulation of, quote, organic, unquote, knowledge of what will effectively induce the public to deceive itself, the normal practice of successful fiction writer and journalist, represents a developed talent out of which both, quote, white, unquote, and quote, black, unquote, propaganda can be shaped, and from which can be developed the scripts in which news, media, and, quote, covert operations, unquote, specialists combine their roles to create an artificial reality for the gullible. This next sentence is all italicized. All Anglo-American psychological warfare operates as the peddling of paranoia. The artisans of this craft often have no real knowledge of the mental processes on which they are operating. They merely have certain talents which have been shown to be workable.
So we got LaRouche talking top-down stuff here, you know, resonating with the new paranoia in the American population after the revelations of Watergate, which peaked in summer of 73 and through early 74 when the hearings were broadcast.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a year after. He's writing this a year after the summer of the Watergate hearings on TV in 73, and he's taking advantage of new paranoia and explaining the hidden ground to it.
Yeah, he's laying out very sort of explicit terms how disinformation works.
Yeah.
And how the media has been co-opted. See, Truman said the industry, you got to beware of the military-industrial complex.
That's Eisenhower.
Eisenhower, yeah. But then now we've McClellan updated that to, we got to beware of the military-industrial entertainment complex.
Or a news complex.
Yeah. or now news entertainment.
Right. So he's saying, he's talking about how the news is managed for people's suspicions of things behind the scenes going on.
Yeah. Well, more than the news, he's talking about how sitcoms and soap operas are massaged, the storylines are massaged to give the public what the public believes is a little secret insight into how intelligence works. But really, they're just giving you this kind of bait to sucker you in so that they can then give you, you know, the best way to lie is to, you know, you give them some truth, give them half a truth to get them to think that they're listening to something real, and then stick the disinformation in there.
Right. Now, this might have been new for people in the 70s reading LaRouche, but it's common awareness now. Nobody believes the information news scenarios.
People do. People are still gullible.
No, they believe it for other reasons, not the content. That's where McClune comes in. It's tribal consensus.
Mm-hmm.
They say, look, the information is so fragmented, we better start acting unified, or we're just going to have total anarchy. So let's pretend we're unified regardless of what the news tells us.
Mm-hmm.
So Reagan began that,
mm-hmm.
that era. People agreed with the image of America as a unified virtual reality, regardless of what's happening. So Reagan ended up saying things like, facts are stupid things.
Mm-hmm.
So you're getting into the post-information levels of the Android meme at this point in the Reagan era.
Mm-hmm.
So LaRouche in the 70s, though, when people thought information meant something and people were concerned about it, they believed the exposés and didn't know the exposés were managed
mm-hmm.
by the secret government.
Right.
So he's trying to expose people how most of the news scenarios that expose hidden operations are written by writers who could write for novels, pop novels, movies, and soap operas. Same kind of level of writing. And he's trying to expose that style of writing is effective, but we need to see through it.
Mm-hmm.
So let me read what he said again and see if we come up with another way of talking about this. Okay. He says the same sort of paranoid games apply to most forms of popular dramatic entertainment. So I think he says, I don't have the preceding paragraph, but he's talking about the paranoia, which he says is the main technique of the Anglo-American psychological warfare, the peddling of paranoia. So he's saying the paranoia that the Watergate scenario created is also used in regular entertainment. So he says, the same sort of paranoid games apply to most forms of popular dramatic entertainments, novels, movies, plays, TV dramas, and most emphatically soap operas in quotes. The ordinary formula, in quotes, or plotto, in quotes, sort of dramatic entertainment so popular on TV is a halfway case between paranoid schizophrenia and the ordinary neurotic perception of events. Their value for the neurotic is both catharsis and equally important, suggesting new fantasy material to the observer. Literary, drama, and TV critics may be regarded as the Duncan Hines of the masturbation circuits. Whereas Duncan Hines was a cake mix.
Yeah, it was a pre-mixed cake mix, comes in a box.
Yeah, prepared stuff. So the this thing about the average citizen being between paranoid schizophrenia and ordinary neurotic perception events, we've covered, 20 or more sessions ago when he describes the immature citizen's mental health.
Yeah, and Croker says we're paranoid for a different reason or maybe even a deeper reason that LaRouche isn't aware of.
Yeah, and yes, LaRouche is analyzing the content effect.
Yeah, Croker's using the word panic, but I'm assuming it's similar to LaRouche's paranoid.
Yeah. So you have LaRouche talking about and believing in the importance of the storyline of news crises and certain events, and then he's showing how that's played up and the average consumer of this information is neurotically looking for some kind of drama, like a soap opera. and looking for a catharsis. So with that in mind...
Now, was he aware of all the paranoid stuff that Beter was talking about back then?
Yeah, I think so, a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, because that was LaRouche's paranoid squared.
That's right. Now, the LaRouche in 76, his organization is notorious for saying that there was going to be a nuclear war in the summer of 76, and that's what Beter was saying at the same time. And then when it didn't happen, people criticized LaRouche, and he said, well, it didn't happen because we exposed it, and therefore
Beter said it didn't happen because he exposed it.
No, Beter, he did it later. He doesn't make that claim. He explained why it didn't happen based on...
No, he made the claim, some telephone calls he made or something, remember the phone lines went down between the two countries and you got the plasma...
That's 1982.
Oh, okay.
That's the one I was involved in.
All right.
And so this is 76.
Okay.
And he's talking about the Rockefellers are still in control is what he's saying, and they're fighting against the Bolsheviks. And that goes on for another year or so until the Battle of the Harvest Moon in September 77. Then the situation changes when the Bolsheviks kill off the Rockefellers and take over the Pentagon.
Mm-hmm.
And then they lead into a nuclear war one, Beter called it, in September 82. And that's the one that Beter came in on. But LaRouche was talking about...
Does LaRouche see the dynamics going on between the Bolsheviks in the same way that Beter talks about that?
Close. LaRouche starts using the term Bolshevism in the early 80s. He talks about imperialism. He has a book called Imperialism, the Final Stage of Bolshevism. So he shifts toward, this essay is talking about Rockefeller's face of fascism. He then goes more towards the European, what Beter would call the Rothschild-funded Bolsheviks and those gangs. That's what LaRouche starts seeing in the late 70s, early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
But Beter's a bit ahead of him on that in emphasizing the Bolsheviks. But LaRouche catches up, and but LaRouche is discussing in what we're reading here the last gasp of the Rockefellers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so he says the best qualified CIA quote covert operations unquote planning executives, so the best ones are to be found among hack paperback novelists and TV dramatists. The credulous neurotic projects reality onto the banal stage and TV screen productions, unquote, because of a strong desire to believe that the combination of painted backgrounds, papier-mâché, costume, and montage has such reality. So he's talking about the immature consumer of TV content, news content. He says, LaRouche says, there's no way in which to conceal repeated covert operations unless the public wishes to be credulous. So there's a slight bottom-up thing there where he's saying the public wants to believe these things, and therefore you can get away with playing off their belief. If the public didn't want to believe these things, didn't neurotically need them, they could see through the covert management immediately, is what LaRouche is saying.
And didn't McLuhan have an aphorism about when we flip from hardware to software warfare instead of Malthusian politics, we flipped into, you know, just give them what they want because they'll, you know, it'll, you know, people will fall asleep in their own hot tub of software or whatever.
Yeah, he said that. So
what did he say? I mean, I'm not paraphrasing him very well, but you know what Marshall said.
McLuhan said that the media environments offered comfort.
Mm-hmm.
Not the content of the media environments, just the media forms themselves, so that someone would read a newspaper like getting into a warm bath.
Yeah, and remember the Tetrad manager said that they didn't have to try to like divide and conquer anymore. You just give them what they want.
Give them the media forms.
Right.
The media massage.
Right.
So LaRouche goes into the content of that media massage and shows how that manages people's brains. So it's like dealing with the psychology of the content.
Right.
He thinks that the content matters.
Yeah.
More than McLuhan.
Right, and he's not so concerned about the form.
That's right.
That the content is being delivered.
Yeah, but what's interesting, the word McLuhan would describe the phenomenon, the word that makes the market, which he wrote about in September 74, you know, same time LaRouche is writing this, McLuhan is talking about the new ground, the post-TV, post-satellite ground, where content has become the new management massage. And so that's why the public gets into conspiratorial thinking in the 70s, and Watergate shows up to act out that theatrical need.
Well, when does Marshall say that happens, the content becomes the...
In the he actually says it in the Playboy interview in March 69, but he starts emphasizing it more in the early 70s. And then especially in this essay he wrote, or op-ed he wrote for the New York Times in September 1974.
Right. So at that point he's already seeing that the media are not really differentiated the way that they used to be in terms of
right.
radio.
It's a seamless web.
Yeah.
The controlling of the one word. The White House now runs the show, and they're defining what reality is the rule. So they're the medium.
Right.
The White House press conference is the medium. The new solar government, global theater implosion effect.
Right.
So the medium now is what McCoon would call the information environment.
Yeah, and it subsumes the radio, the TV, the newspaper, and all the media.
Yeah, they're all seamlessly fluid, feeding off each other. But it's the beginning of PAC journalism.
Yeah, you call that mixed corporate media feeding off of each other.
Yeah, but it's the beginning of what became called PAC journalism, this inordinate coverage of whatever the president is doing, extreme coverage, all media revolving around that.
Right. But then the presidents always hate the media because they feel that the media is operating in contrast to their agendas.
Yeah, well, the pressure on them, since they don't understand what McCoon was talking about, they just feel that the consensus building of media should be what they would be the handmaiden of. And as the media, the different forms have become obsolete in the 70s, they fight more and more and compete. And as McCoon said, the more you compete, the more you become the same. But still, it becomes a more increasingly fragmented society because everybody takes a different spin on the word that makes the market.
Yeah.
So Nixon sent out Agnew to knock the media in 1970, calling a bunch of effete snobs and a bunch of other strange language he used. That became a famous situation that McCoon writes about in the book, Take the Day of the Executive's Dropout. He actually did a whole Marshall McLuhan Dooline newsletter in 1969, early 70, it's called Agnew Agonistes. It's based on Eliot's incomplete poem, Sweeney Agonistes. So he goes on analyzing how Agnew lashes out at the media and how Agnew doesn't understand what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
So now LaRouche is taking what the word that makes the market is doing and showing the fake nature of the information scenarios.
Now, so you're saying McLuhan might agree with LaRouche at this point if McLuhan thinks that the content is now...
Yes, I was just going to say that. That's right. There's a merging here. Because LaRouche, he doesn't come to the... He may not understand McLuhan, but he sees that the word makes the market and he thinks that's very significant. And he's telling you how they manage it. And McLuhan would agree that the scenario is being managed from the White House. And McLuhan would point out how these hack writers making these scenarios have no clue of the effects that they're creating and therefore end up getting knocked out like Watergate did to Nixon.
Mm-hmm.
McLuhan still talks about effects.
Right.
LaRouche is tending to talk about the content and what is the truth of action.
And LaRouche is running for president because he wants to become the word that makes the market.
That's right, yeah. And he's up against Kissinger, who is the trigger man for the word that makes the market at that time, for the White House.
Mm-hmm.
So the formal effect that McLuhan is describing in the New York Times is the situation that LaRouche is focusing on and becoming increasingly seen as a megalomaniac in response to it, because he wants to become the word that makes the market.
Mm-hmm.
And he may not do it right if he did take over, because he wouldn't be aware of the cultural contradictions, blah, 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 that McLuhan goes into.
Mm-hmm.
So here's where... So LaRouche is trying to educate the public to not be so credulous. And if they were not so credulous, they'd see through the covert operations or content stage management.
Right.
And in a way, turn off the media or turn off taking it in.
Mm-hmm.
But he says the public is largely uneducated, neurotic people who need these soap operas.
Right. Now, being on the Secret Council of 10 and doing Tetrad managing at that time, was he an aggravation to you and your operation?
No. He was for some members of the Council of 10, but remember, he was propped up by me for my own operation because I was trying to become the word that makes a market.
Mm.
And now McLuhan starts writing about Watergate around this time also, and he calls it theater. He sees it as theater, too. So LaRouche is saying that theater is a hack theater, pseudo and low banal quality theater, typical of your TV and novel fare, F-A-R-E. And he's saying we need higher quality information in this theater, whereas McLuhan is just showing how the theater is a confluence of all kinds of factors that necessitate the theatrical presentation. He's not analyzing the quality of the information. He's explaining why it has to be theatrical.
Mm-hmm.
So LaRouche says there's no way in which to conceal repeated covert operations unless the public wishes to be credulous. Now, McLuhan would say, no, people need new scenarios every day, credulous or not. They need content for their TV, so you're going to have more and more scandals, not just Watergate. LaRouche says, give that public a fantasy of the sort to which it is susceptible, and no amount of mere fact, there he is relying on fact, and no amount of mere fact will easily dissuade the majority of such persons from believing in whatever illusion the covert operation is designed to create. So McLuhan would say the illusion is real, not a pseudo-event. It's necessary. And LaRouche takes the old literary 19th century view that there's truth and illusion. There's an argument.
Mm-hmm.
And a disconnect. So he says, LaRouche says, the application of the calculated deception of the successful hack novelist and dramatist to the so-called documentary film and nonfiction expose. So now he's saying that the part of the CIA scenario is, yes, the CIA knows people won't really believe these scenarios, so you got to give them a release mechanism, a safety or a valve to release the tensions and dissonance. So you tell them, you present exposés of what really happened, telling the story behind the scenes. And LaRouche says those stories are even on the level of hack novels.
Mm-hmm.
So he's putting down the antidote, the limited hangout, was the phrase that became popular later, of the CIA covert operation scenario. So he says, the application of the calculated deception of the successful hack novelist and dramatist, you know, applying that to the so-called documentary film, in quotes, and nonfiction expose, in quotes, is the connecting link between outright pornography writing and the techniques for designing a CIA-type covert operation scenario.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, then he has some brackets. If by chance a covert operation is blown, in quotes, the CIA's obvious remedy is to prompt one of its subsidiaries or sister agencies to whip up a fresh expose of the CIA.
By subsidiaries, he's talking about media outlets.
Oh, yeah, or other parts of the CIA. Sister agencies.
Mm-hmm.
The CIA's obvious remedy. Give the credulous public a, quote, believable expose scenario, and the expose provides a deeper cover than the original plot itself. So the original plot never gets revealed, and the pseudo-plot, if fragile, will, and this is sort of like Tetrad management, will be covered by the CIA's assets, who will then allow an expose of the original pseudo-plot. And that will necessarily make the public think there's freedom of opinion, freedom of expression, and freedom of truth getting out, because the fake scenario has been countered by the, quote, truth, or
right.
New expose.
And you pointed out earlier that it was 1947 when it was signed into law that the president could lie to the...
Yeah, the National Security Agency Act, National Security Act.
Yeah, well, that was 47?
Yeah. Now, and so the UFO people get nutty on that because it happened right after Roswell. So they think it all came in because of the Roswell UFO incident.
Uh-huh.
Anyways, But another way to say it is 1947 is when the World Commerce Corporation and other entities were cobbled together, like 800 companies, and the global corporate Rockefeller-dominated economy was finally instituted in 47 after 2 years of repair work after the end of World War II.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a bit chaotic in 46, 47, and that's the scenario. That period, 45 to 47, is sort of the content of Thomas Pynchon's novel Gravity's Rainbow. He describes the chaos right after, leading up to World War II's ending with the Hiroshima bomb, and then just a little bit after that.
Mm.
So that chaotic period, it gets consolidated by 47, and so that's when the global corporate guys can bring in the National Security Act.
So this stuff LaRouche is talking about here in 74 has been going on since 47.
Right, and he's talking about, that's what he refers to in this essay, you read the rest of it. He's outlining how these scenarios were laid out in the 50s and 60s.
Mm-hmm.
The Watergate is just another same similar situation following the pattern. So LaRouche is, we're going to read in the next paragraph, what he thinks is the medium is paranoia, an emotional state, playing off the gullible, the schizophrenic, the immature.
Yeah. Is there a direct relationship between that and Croker's panic?
Panic is, a more comprehensive multimedia environmental scene.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, it could be considered similar. But the way Croker writes about it is a lot more complex than LaRouche does.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Because Croker is going, processing what we're reading about from LaRouche, processing it through McLuhan, and then going into the post-McLuhan phase.
Yeah, and he's looking at the hidden ground.
Yeah, that's the McLuhan part.
Yeah, I mean, LaRouche is looking at the hidden narrative, and Croker's looking at the hidden...
techno-cultural ground.
Right.
Which is very close to McLuhan.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that it's a different technological environment in the 80s than McLuhan had in the 50s and 60s. So let's read this last paragraph. LaRouche says, "It is not accidental, therefore, that the leaders in all branches of psychological warfare have included leading dramatists, novelists, and newspapermen. The accumulation of, quote, organic knowledge of what will effectively induce the public to deceive itself, the normal practice of the successful fiction writer and journalist," so even journalism is considered deception, "represents a developed talent out of which both white and black propaganda can be shaped," white and black in quotes, "and from which can be developed the scripts in which news media and covert operations specialists combine their roles to create an artificial reality for the gullible. So there's LaRouche talking about the management of the word that makes the market. And he's saying that since it's a fiction, a pseudo-event, then you need creative people, like novelists, newspapermen, and dramatists. So LaRouche is pointing out the pseudo-level of the information environment.
And so when you say the White House is the word that makes the market, you're also talking about all the institutions that support the White House.
Yeah, it's an imploded environment.
Yeah.
Everything is involved with the White House, the word that makes the market. Now, McLuhan says that what LaRouche is complaining about is not a pseudo-environment. The fact is you can put out any scenario, white or black, and then have a new scenario 2 weeks later and another one after that, because the public needs consumption of information scenarios as its main, you could say, addiction.
Mm-hmm.
LaRouche accurately describes the word that makes the market, but he sees the frailty of this news stories and the lack of factual data and how it doesn't hold up over time as a problem for the managers of the imploded word that makes the market, and for the consumers. McLuhan doesn't see that as a problem. But McLuhan tries to explain why that isn't a problem, that the problem is the fact that people need to consume information, need information involvement due to the nature of the mixed corporate media. But McLuhan, the LaRouche would point out that McLuhan cannot get on the media and have a press conference and get everybody to realize that. So then it flips back to LaRouche, whose conspiracy and control of the word that makes the market is an important aspect that McLuhan is not dealing with.
Except LaRouche can't get on there and make everybody aware of it either.
That's right. He thinks that he can educate people through newspapers and occasional TV broadcasts. He believes that the audience will need and want to be informed, and once they hear it, hear the truth, then they'll act on it and not be dupes. And McLuhan's saying counters LaRouche, who won the argument at that point. He said there's a conspiracy to suppress McLuhan dominating the word that makes the market, or McLuhan's message dominating. And McLuhan says, yes, but you'll never get the truth out because people can't stay on one point very long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and also even from LaRouche has to admit these guys that manage and deceive through the news outlets are doing the same thing with him, with the LaRouche image and the LaRouche information, that they're doing with the information that LaRouche is, LaRouche is busy trying to correct all the misinformation that they're putting out on all these areas, but he's also got to straighten out all the misinformation they're putting out on him, because they're doing a sabotage on his operation just like all these other operations.
All right, so your point is?
I'm not making a point, really. I'm just making an observation.
That he's got a problem there.
Yeah, I mean, he's like running up a hill of sand, and every time he sticks his foot in the sand, he slips back a foot because they're massaging. You know, he's out there trying to create an image and trying to get information out there, and they're massaging him and his information. Just in the same way that he says that they're massaging other political and assassination information and everything else. So LaRouche's got to realize that he will always be ineffectual because it will always undermine his operation.
Right, and so he should maybe join McLuhan temporarily, get them to have a media fast, turn off the TV environment, maybe the electric environment, and then everybody can read LaRouche's newspaper. And then realize the facts and be very careful when they turn the TV environment back on. So McLuhan said, before you do anything like that LaRouche is hoping to do, you need to turn off and modulate the amount of time people can have access to a TV or electronic environment.
Mm-hmm.
And that ain't going to happen, though McLuhan proposed it, that no content problems, we could say, or efficiency or truth problems could be solved unless you modulated and controlled the amount of TV environment there is.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the first thing to do. Then he said you would look at the problems.
Yeah.
So LaRouche eventually becomes discredited because he's always saying a nuclear war is coming or economic crash, and goes on for 30 years doing this.
Yeah.
And so nobody pays attention to him. But then other agencies come up, Noam Chomsky or Fairness and Accuracy in Media. There's all kinds of them. Now you have Air America getting on there, and they're day in, day out, the journalists and radio hosts there demanding truth and information, arguing about Bush lying. And the thing is, they still believe that there's information that if all the people heard, they'd get smart and vote appropriately.
Mm-hmm.
So the McLuhan would come in and say, well, it's natural for North Americans to think that content information matters, and that's an archetype and a meme in this culture because it came out of the print society, and it will continue for 100 years. In other words, McLuhan explains why people won't get his message. Americans won't get it.
You know what? I think it's becoming obvious that Americans don't care about information anymore. I just saw a little thing on Exposé that pointed out how many of the news anchor guys now don't actually, deliver, and that's the way it was, like the Walter Cronkite. They get on and they have their spin and they rant. You got Bill O'Reilly and Lou Dobbs and a couple others that I can't think of off the top of my head right now. They all come on and they put a spin on the news and they rant. And they all have, different, and they all run their own little circus. Their rants are all, they all have their own little eddy or whirlpool or spin, so they're all
Rumpelstiltskin.
They're all a little different from each other, so you find the one that you resonate to, and then you agree with them, and you get focused on that,
Okay, so yeah, we'll go into more of this on the chart, but when I do my chart, but that's that's the fragmentation, and the point is that people, I mean, I lay this out in the memo to Prince Charles, everybody gets into their mythic stage. What's the definition of mythic stage? A myth is a mixture of the media profile that you want that resonates with your psychographics.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So a certain style of person will like Riley. Another person, kind of type of person will like Al Franken. And so that's your mythic stage. And it's not myth in terms of an illusion. Myth means compressed, quick encapsulation and pattern recognition. So everybody prefers their style of pattern recognition about the post-information society.
Mm-hmm.
So you put on a style of information. No longer are you matching truth to reality. So, yes, this began 20 years ago, and Rush Limbaugh was a good example of that,
yeah.
Or Howard Stern. So it's got more and more fragmented as the world got more and more digital. But the McLuhan point, that information is irrelevant, it's the engaging with an image of what you think your culture is or what you've been conditioned to think it is by the media you use is what's being played out. That is the new form of information. So we have to define literate, pictorial, and verbal information. That's 19th century content, as opposed to mixed corporate media, experiential massage surfing as an informational experience. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And that complexity is not being dealt with by LaRouche.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But LaRouche has a guaranteed niche market of disillusioned people who are trained through literacy in the American environment, in the American media world, and their schooling, to believe in true, that there is true information and someone's got it and the truth is out there, right?
Yeah.
Was that X-Files? The truth is out there. We need to find that pictorial, literate, verbal statement of truth, and that is a solution to our problems. Mm. LaRouche plays on that bias, that need.
Yeah. I wonder if he'd be too hot for the Coast to Coast show. He seems like he'd be a good one for that show because of his, you know, paranoid conspiracy bias, his visual, you know, bias in that way.
He's probably been around too long. He has the TV body stigma. He's already been smeared, and
yeah.
And so George Norrie and these guys, they get on newer versions of that.
Yeah.
I mean, you got Alex Jones, Jeff Renz. You got all kinds of people on the digital alternative landscape.
Uh-huh.
So LaRouche, what he offers is not as... You got younger versions and more flashy images presenting the same style of truth bias.
Right.
That's why I put LaRouche in the book. He's an archetype of what has become what's called rampant conspiracy theorizing on the Internet.
Mm-hmm.
He lays out an educated statement of that preference, that need, and that bias.
Mm-hmm.
So he says, just to continue, maybe we got interrupted. I'll say, the accumulation of organic, in quotes, knowledge of what will effectively induce the public to deceive itself, the normal praxis of the successful fiction writer and journalist, represents a developed talent out of which both white and black propaganda can be shaped, and from which can be developed the scripts in which news media and covert operations specialists combine their roles to create an artificial reality for the gullible. There's the beginning of LaRouche perceiving, from a literate point of view, virtual reality. The mixing together of the news media and the CIA managers of the word that makes the manager,
yeah.
Makes the market. He says, but then he has an italics, all Anglo-American psychological warfare operates as the peddling of paranoia. Now, LaRouche is seeing this as psychological or interior mental landscape propaganda. He doesn't see the sociological or macro environments that McLuhan's talking about, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's still talking as a literate person looking at information being sent from one mind to another mind, or a bunch of minds to another bunch of minds.
Mm-hmm.
That's called psychological warfare. But what about the media environmental massage warfare? McLuhan says, as long as we've got TV bombarding us and massaging us, we ain't going to have any of our 19th century goals established.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to become a third world country. So that's a Trojan horse that needs to be evacuated, McLuhan say, before you deal with the content.
Yeah.
So then LaRouche says, the artisans of this craft, which is the American Anglo-American psychological warfare, so that's the global government, the Rockefeller friendly face of fascism. The artisans of this craft often have no real knowledge of the mental processes on which they are operating. They merely have certain talents which have been shown to be workable. It's sort of like a Howard Stern. Yeah, it's a talent to complain and joke about whatever is happening based on his personal preferences and idiosyncrasies. He doesn't analyze his mental processes. He just operates on instinct.
Yeah.
But LaRouche doesn't realize they don't need to be experts on stuff. They just need people who can write quick scenarios and create content for people because there's such a need, rapid need, 24/7.
Yeah.
So that's where the creators' creativity becomes suspect, or the dumb take over more and more, or what's perceived as a dumb, but it ain't the dumb. It's just that you got people, all kinds of people can offer scenarios.
Yeah. On your radio play,
Who's Forgotten Furry Lynn?
Furry Lynn. Don't you have some sound bites in there going into the relationship between the networks and that are being bought by the military intelligence agencies or something?
That might have been a Mae Brussel part. Mae Brussel's on there, or it could be a LaRouche part. LaRouche is on there.
Could it have possibly even been Worcester?
Not the way you've said it.
Yeah, that's worth going back and checking out, because there's some hard facts there about the relationship between military intelligence buying the news networks, and you really get to see how that gives them an outlet to, you know, massage the news.
Well, what people realize, McLuhan used to criticize the 60s activists who complained about the military-industrial complex. He said the fact that they're hyphenated means that the environment has moved on to another level. So nowadays, you know, by the 90s, people talked about the military-industrial entertainment complex. So they were starting to get closer to what McLuhan was talking about. But what people didn't understand was that advertising was a military operation way more warlike or military.